Welcome everyone to the program, and today my guest is a doctor from Taiwan. His name is Warren Wang, and he's got a lot going on in his life right now, and he is an emergency medical specialist who has a primary care practice in Taiwan. He was on the ground during the emergence of the pandemic in Taiwan, and he's here today to provide us with some insight. And the reason I bring him here today is because, in a sense, Taiwan and Toronto are sister cities. We were both uniquely affected by SARS back in 2003, and the difference between the two in terms of how they responded to the current pandemic is very notable, and it's worth exploring. And that's why I bring Dr. Wang on here today to help us understand the differences and help us understand what doing it right looks like, essentially. Dr. Wang, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, I mentioned that you are a medical doctor who has a practice in Taiwan, but I'm going down your list of things here, and there's like a million things. How do you find the time for all this? And the fact that you're even dedicating a bit of time to us today, I'm eternally grateful. But tell us a little bit about yourself.
Actually, the martial arts changed my life. I've always wanted to do martial arts, even when I was a kid, but I was never into it until I got to college in the States. And then, and then I got into jiu-jitsu, Brazilian jiu-jitsu specifically. And then that kind of changed my life and how I dealt things and how I thought about things and how I decided a lot of stuff in my life. So how I got into emergency medicine was because back then, in 2003, I had a little club going on in Taiwan. It was the first jiu-jitsu club in Taiwan, and we started that club. And we started competing internationally, all over Asia. And I was a fifth-year medical student. Well, in Taiwan, it's a seven-year program. So I was a fifth-year medical student looking for which specialty I should go. And I figured, well, if we're traveling all the time and I have, friends and my teammates are getting hurt, then, I can go into ER and I can help them out. And also ERs, I was tricked into thinking, oh, you work, like X amount of shifts and then you're off for the rest of the month. So I figured, okay, I'll work 14 days straight, and then I can be 14 days off, or I can go to travel and compete. That was wrong, of course, but and I just eventually I kind of fell in love with emergency medicine. I think that's emergency doctors, like we know everything, but we don't know like everything in depth. But we can help almost everybody that comes through the door, right? And that's what I wanted. That's why I got into ER, and I was an ER doctor for about 4 or 5 years before I have my other interest in martial arts, and I want to continue to develop that program in Taiwan. So I started my general practice clinic in Taiwan. I've been doing that for about 11, 12 years.
And you run a jiu-jitsu academy, I see, as well.
Yes, we're the oldest academy in Taiwan. Currently, we have, I own and operate three of them. We have two more affiliates. So a total of 5 schools in Taiwan.
Incredible. And you divide your time between Taiwan and California, where your kids are currently getting their education, and where you currently are right now. You've been there since March-ish?
Middle of March.
Yeah,
Right before spring break, yeah.
Gotcha. So you were talking about back in 2003 when the SARS crisis hit, and you were in Taiwan during that time?
Yes, I was a medical student, and I have senior colleagues that have died in the ER looking after SARS patients.
Can you give us a picture of what it was like back then on the ground in 2003 with the SARS epidemic in Taiwan?
Well, I think with SARS, I was just a medical student, so I wasn't really involved in all the medicine.
On a societal level.
Well, I knew it was a big thing that was spreading, but Taiwan was really quick to react, and we locked down the hospital that was spreading it. So all the doctors, nurses, staff, they were locked in the hospital; they couldn't get out. So it never really got out in the public, never really got in the community. And luckily, SARS, it was a virus that killed really fast. So before it got a chance to spread, it killed off the host.
I see.
So essentially it killed itself. And then when the weather started warming up, it couldn't spread anymore. So SARS was a virus that wasn't prone to, you know, to be in the heat. So I think it started in March, and then by June it was gone.
Right.
So we were fortunate that way. We locked down really fast, and then they just pretty much killed all the hosts, and then the weather got warmer, and that was the end of SARS. And I think, you know, so we kind of had this idea of a continuous scale. And of course, Hong Kong blew up and China blew up afterwards.
Because it originated in Hong Kong, correct?
Yeah. It kept going on in Hong Kong longer than it did in Taiwan.
In the Kowloon district? Is that, if yes. I recall correctly, yeah.
Yeah, I remember it was there for at least half a year to the end of the year in Hong Kong. I mean, you kept hearing news of it. But then SARS, it was quick and ended quick. Of course, it devastated Taiwan economically, financially,
yep.
because it was a huge scare because nobody knew what was going on. It was like a new novel virus. And was it going to affect our lives and economy and finance? Stock market crashed.
Right.
The housing crashed. Everything crashed.
Right. And you were, and that's why I say Taipei and Taiwan are kind of sister examples of what happened in Toronto, because Toronto was uniquely affected by SARS as well. It was one of the first cities for it to emerge in. And we, back in 2003, I recall, we experienced a massive economic downturn. I mean, right. We had what was called SARS stock. Back then, it was this right. giant concert in order to try to reboot the tourist economy in Toronto, and that was right. only about 8,000 cases worldwide, and it had this giant impact yeah. on these major cities within these countries. And just for people who don't know, I mean, Taiwan as a country is quite unique in the sense that it's separate from China, the Chinese mainland, but only 90 kilometers. But it's a separate country. And for those who haven't been there, it's a fully developed country. It has a very robust economy. And as we saw with the COVID pandemic, it had a very robust response to it. So fast forwarding to, you know, December, January of this year on the ground in Taiwan. Can you explain a little bit of how the original understanding of the pandemic manifested in Taiwan among its leadership, among its medical community, and how the response kind of unfolded? And I'm speaking about maybe late December, even I recall reading something where they were even monitoring rumors about it, about COVID-19 back in November. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well, yeah, from experience. So I'm still, you know, in contact with a lot of my ER colleagues, and I'm also the chairman of the clinic association. So, you know, we have our, group chats and stuff like that. So it was like end of November and December, or around that time. It was strange because we're seeing a lot of patients with fever, but you know, they were flu A, flu B negative, adenovirus negative, but they had similar signs, but we couldn't figure out what, you know, because usually by that time we start seeing a lot of flus, right?
This was back in November, December. You started seeing patients with fevers. And, wow.
So we had ideas. Something is different. Why is it different than the previous flus? Like it looks like a flu. It feels like a flu, like in clinic wise, but we weren't getting. They were coming back flu A, flu B positive, right?
Because that's a revelation. Because I think the first official case that Taiwan acknowledged was on January 20th. I guess that's after they had the information of how to identify it. So it had been in the country much earlier than that?
Well, I'm guessing because we didn't really know what it was.
Right.
We just saw a lot of patients that looked like the flu, but didn't test positive for the flu or the other virus.
And you saw a notable spike. You and your colleagues saw a notable spike.
Oh, of course, yeah. A lot of fevers going on. Yeah. So, you know, we knew something was... in Taiwan is very different from, I think, a lot of Western medical society, culture, where, you know, in Taiwan it's very easy to go see a doctor. There's clinics everywhere on the street, and it's very cheap. Right?
I noticed that when I was there in March, and I noticed I was walking down the street, and there were sidewalk clinics, and it was amazing that you could access.
Right?
Yeah, it was incredible.
Yeah. For like, you know, example, I see an average of 160 patients a day. It's ridiculous, right? Because they're just walk-in patients. There's no, you know, hi, my name is Dr. Wong. How are you feeling? You know, because I'm their family doctor. So I know that I have seen him for 10, 15 years. My dad, you know, my dad's also a doctor. So he's right. at that clinic for 20 years, you know, so we've taken care of a lot of families. So there's none of that cordial, you know, introduction and all that. And so like you're just running through patients all day long.
Right. It's like a treadmill or whatever, a conveyor belt kind of thing.
It's a factory just in and out all day.
So that's incredible.
You know, yeah. So most clinics are like that. They're walk-in clinics. You know, you don't need an appointment. You just go in. So because it's so affordable and so
accessible,
the access is so easy, accessible. So patients tend to go to see their doctor for very, very little things.
Wow.
Right? Not like in the States or in Canada. You're like, you have a fever for 3, 4, 5 days. You're like, oh, I'm really not feeling well. Maybe I'll go to urgent care, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe I'll call my pediatrician. Maybe I'll call my doctor.
I was actually in emergency last night. I had a thing I needed to get dealt with. And I was even just like contemplating, no, I'll deal with this pain. And I walked in and I was the only person there because everybody was scared to go. So I felt like a king walking in and out of there. And shouts out to Toronto General. You guys did a fantastic job last night. but yeah, you're right. We are very apprehensive about going to the doctor. And I noticed there, it's just so accessible.
Yeah, it's accessible and it's relatively cheap. So, you know, we tend to see a lot of patients. That's what I was getting. We tend to see a lot of patients. So we have that familiarity with certain disease, you know, if it's a flu season, we tend to see, whoa, there's a big number of, you know, people with the flu coming in. Maybe it's enterovirus season. We start seeing people, you know, the kids with enterovirus, you know, fever and spots on there, you know. So we tend to see trends very, very early, especially in the clinical practice. Yeah, same thing in the ER as well. ER is also very accessible in Taiwan. We can't refuse patients.
Right.
So you can go to the ER anytime, anywhere, you know, and the doctors have to see you. So the doctors are already seeing something that they're not used to.
So you noticed discussion, an increase in the chatter in November and December about this kind of unique new ailment that was emerging in the clinic community. When did you start noticing higher up officials, whether it be political or political medical staff, start ringing alarms?
It was actually really quick. I think it was, you know, starting January, all this chatter started going on that, you know, we all need to wear masks, and all the clinics started talking, you know, if the patient doesn't have a mask, they can't come into the clinics, you know, and you start seeing less and less people going in stores now, you know. And then, like, because I have to travel a lot. Then the airport started checking. There's questionnaires. And, you know, I fly back from Singapore, and they would have questionnaires, and they would take down your cell phone number, and they would call you, they would text you, you know, to make sure that you're okay. So there's all these forms you have to fill out. They're trying to make sure that if you're traveling into Taiwan, they know where you are at all times, so they can trace you, right?
So what you're saying is that the response was swift, because I recall
it's very, very early. Yes,
I think it was December 29th is when China put it on the WHO's radar, and then I think it was December 30th or 31st where Taiwan started instituting restrictions. As far as what I recall about the timeline.
I think the timeline was, according to what we put out to the WHO, we sent them an email end of, I think, May 31st, right? Or 30th or 31st, about, you know, we suspect there is a virus going on.
December 31st?
I think it was December
31st. Yeah, that's right. I remember,
And then, like, I think right after, because I think we're also very fortunate that because there's so much trade going on between Taiwan and China, and a lot of businessmen are working there, and they come back. So they tend to bring the virus back a little bit earlier, whereas tourism or business-wise. So we were probably one of the first countries to get infected from these patients, right?
Right.
So we were able to respond first, and because we're so close and we have such tight business and trade and tourism and family and a lot of stuff like that, I think that's what made Taiwan very, very careful.
Yeah. And obviously there are, and I don't expect you to speak to this, but there are political tensions between China and Taiwan. So Taiwan is very much careful to monitor the going, what's happening on the ground in China. And I remember reading one article where they were just keeping an eye on social media, and they were seeing reports of this virus emerge.
And I think that's when we,
So back in November,
We're the first country to, I think the first thing that was passed is we stopped all flights from Wuhan to Taiwan. That was one of the first things that started. And then after that, you know, the precautions kept going up step by step, you know, kept increasing. And then all the all the flights got shut down from China, you know. So it was a incremental change, but it changed quite fast. So it started with that, stopping all the flights. And we were really afraid because it was right before Chinese New Year's. And we knew Chinese New Year, you would get this influx of businessmen coming back to visit their family in Taiwan, right? Or students coming back to Taiwan to visit. So when we said, you know, no flights from Wuhan, you know, a lot of families and a lot of businessmen, a lot of students are stuck in Wuhan and couldn't come back to Taiwan. It was a really tough decision Taiwan had to make.
Mm-hmm.
But then
it turned out to be their correct one, obviously.
It was correct. And then we shut down all the, at first, you know, there were flights from Beijing and Shanghai still. And afterwards, I think we just shut all those down.
And this all happened in the early days of January.
Right before Chinese New Year.
And just for the folks at home, Chinese New Year is at the end of January. So it depends,
right? This year is at the end of January.
It was at the end of January. So even before the WHO declares this a global threat, I think that was January 30th, they declared it a global threat, a global health threat. Taiwan had already put in place all the controls prior to anything happening, because the common misconception, especially in North America or Western countries generally, is that nobody saw this coming. Nobody could tell. I mean, we have from our own federal government, we have comments as early as January 27th saying that we have all the controls in place, we have the best practices in place on the ground, and I'm seeing what was happening in Taiwan in early March, I was like, this is the way to deal with it. I mean, everything was still open. I mean, I think they shut down a little bit for a couple weeks in February just to get a better control. But I know that
The only thing that was shut down was right after Chinese New Year, the schools were shut down.
Yeah. I have a friend who teaches at one of the schools. We have a mutual friend who teaches at one of the schools, and it was shut down for a couple of weeks. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was just for 2 weeks or three, 2 to 3 weeks, you know, just to make sure that after Chinese year, we didn't get this huge explosion of patients.
Right.
You know, and then we're lucky that it didn't escalate, you know, right after Chinese year. So I think.
So imagine that, Canada, there was only a 2 week shutdown of schools in Taiwan. That was the lockdown extent that to which they locked down. I want to talk about
everything else is still open.
I want to talk about the 124 point plan that they had on the shelf in response to their experience with SARS. They had developed it in the aftermath of SARS, and they had this plan on the shelf ready to go and implemented it in mid-January. I think it was January 12th. I think they started implementing a couple points on this plan a day and accelerated it. And part of those aspects were, you know, a public awareness campaign, increasing manufacturing of masks and PPE, the community clinics that we spoke about earlier, increasing the presence of those. Can you speak to that plan and its initial rollout as you started seeing it from the ground?
Well, I think it started as SARS because medically, you know, because I worked at ER. I remember, like, we have to, after SARS, we would have to train. Every year we have to go through training to, you know, in case another epidemic or pandemic breaks out, you know, like, setting up tents outside, you know, having testing stations, you know, having temperature check stations. I mean, those were not there before. Those are all started after SARS, right? So anytime there's a big flu, a flu epidemic in Taiwan, or the avian flu that was the H1N1, avian flu that also, you know, mm-hmm. So every time we have this kind of flu going on, or pandemic or epidemic going on, those things are always set up. Like every time there's something going on, we set that up. So I think,
so there's, you know, a lot of emergency preparedness in the aftermath of of SARS. You had yearly training on emergency preparedness to deal with pandemics, including tents and mobilization and PPE.
Putting on the PPEs and how to wrap yourself, how to protect yourself.
Incredible.
That we, I mean, as a resident doctor, that we had to practice, like, I think twice a year. You know, it was mandatory that you practice this. You know, all the doctors, and at least in the ER, all the doctors and nurses, how to change the layout for the ER, how to make sure, you know, there's enough isolation stations and all isolation quarters, you know, for patients, and enough negative pressure rooms. I mean, those are all set up just like right after SARS, and it was practiced every single year.
Excellent. And so I'm not familiar. I mean, I'm not a member of the Canadian medical community, so I wouldn't know what their preparedness regime is. But we had, you know, weeks of discussions of how do we get enough masks? How do we prepare for this? People being caught flat-footed in the U.S. as well, of how this can go. I mean, I would go to the government website, and there was an option there, essentially calling on Canadian manufacturing to step up to the plate and help start manufacturing some of this PPE. It's like, what, we did not have a stockpile anywhere, or, I mean, there's no off-the-shelf plan to deal with this. And it was just incredible compared to how Taiwan dealt with it.
Well, I think we were also short on masks, but I think, we're fortunate that we're, the country's economy is very textile dominant. We do have a lot of textile. Most of the textiles, you know, whether it's for the big brands for clothing, apparels, is pretty much all from Taiwan. And we have the skills. I mean, before we used to manufacture some masks, but not all of it. But we do have very good manufacturing infrastructure that was already in place. So what happened was these factory owners from different trades, I think they all came together. I think within a week they put out, they designed and made and manufactured machines that are able to pump out masks all day long. And that wasn't there before. It was all done within a week.
Yeah.
And I think we're just fortunate that because we have the material and we have the knowledge, we have the manufacturing skills.
And you had the 124-point plan off the shelf. And so the leadership stepped up and initiated it. I want to talk numbers
Go ahead. Sorry. Another thing I think is also worth mentioning is Taiwanese people are very accustomed to wearing masks.
I noticed.
I mean,
I've been there probably six times, and every time I land, I'm like, "Is there something going on? Everyone's wearing a mask."
Exactly. Right. So when the government says everybody mandatory puts a mask on, nobody said no because they're so used to it.
I know. I felt like a ghost riding the underground, and it was like, maybe I'll get my bandana and put it around my face. I don't know. Because everyone's just staring at me. It's like, oh, he's one of those.
Yeah. So I think it's one of those things where we're very comfortable wearing masks, and it was just a shortage of masks. So once the government provided you the masks, so basically everybody, you know, goes, there's a bunch of pharmacies around, and you go to a certain pharmacy at a certain time, and you get a number, and you pick up a certain number of masks for that week.
Yeah, I think it was 10 a week that you were provided just as free as part of your medical service. I remember seeing one of these lineups. I can't remember which district it was, but I was jogging to the gym. I was going to the gym in the middle of the pandemic, in Taiwan, that's how locked down they had it. I mean, so as I was jogging, I see this giant lineup going into a pharmacy, and that's what it was. People were picking up their 10 masks for the week, which is a part of that 124-point plan that they instituted. And it's incredible that people had... It was such a robust response. People soaked it up as just part of normal way of doing things. And as a result, the numbers don't lie for themselves. I mean, I think as of today, there are 429 cases in total and only six deaths. And I think they've gone 4 or 5 days now.
300 some plus people were discharged. And most of the people that are infected are people that flew into Taiwan.
Yeah, it says of the 429 cases, 343 were imported, 55 were locally transmitted, and 31 came from Navy crews. So it came from, I guess, boats or whatever. But yeah, only 6 deaths, and they've gone, I think they're on their 5th day of 0 new cases. By contrast, and people say, oh, they're a small country. No, well, Taiwan is a population of 24 million people. In contrast, Canada is a population of 37.6 million people. So it's not that much different. It's a few million, one major big city, and then you're close, or a couple major big cities, and you're close. By contrast, Canada has now confirmed 53,236 cases as of today. It's April 30th. And 3,184 deaths, and their whole society is shut down. Taiwan right now hustling and bustling as normal as they have been since middle of the whole time, actually, other than the school shutdown. They've been continuing life as normal.
And bars and clubs.
Yeah. I have a funny photo. It's on my Facebook of me walking into a bar. It was a craft brewery in Taipei, and the guy's like spraying my hands, you know, checking my temperature.
Yeah,
and like
that started really early.
Yeah, I sent that photo back to friends, and they're like, "What the hell's going on?" And I'm like, "It's the normal thing here." And even I went to the gym. If you go into a gym, a hotel, a grocery store, pharmacy, a bar, any kind
anywhere,
they have the thermal scanners, which I imagine were given out also as part of the program, and hand sanitization sprays, and they were doing that everywhere. And I come in March, I think it was March 15th, I arrive in Toronto. I'm going through customs, and I haven't...
Nothing,
I didn't get a thermal scan. I didn't get any sanitization. There were two Canadian Border Service agents, and not to criticize them, because they were probably overwhelmed, but there were a couple CBSA agents who were standing in the hallway, the gangway, I guess, from the airplane, and about 60 to 70% of the people off our plane straight from Taiwan, and maybe they understood that Taiwan is a relatively safe place, but 60 to 70 people straight from our plane just walk straight past them while they question, you know, a handful of people about where they were in the last 2 weeks. And I was like, oh my God, Canada's screwed. They have no idea what's coming, and they're screwed. And of course, and I think it was the very next day the Prime Minister got on TV and said, we're initiating a lockdown, or at least starting to shut things down, close the borders. Flights from Canada were the thing with flights into Canada were the first restrictions. I think it was limited to Canadian citizens only. And then everything else just started unraveling from there. And you can see how it probably is in California. It's very similar in Toronto, where literally everything is shut down. And people are going stir crazy from what I can see. But so the contrast between the two examples of getting ahead of it early versus too much too late is hopefully illustrated to the people watching this, because that's probably the main thing I wanted to get across in having you on the program today is that point, is that Yeah, right. People did get it right. And the reason they got it right is because they learned from past experiences that we should have learned from, but we didn't. And now we're paying the price. And it's in the beginning,
a lot of people thought Taiwan was just overreacting. But I think being so close to China and seeing, you know, it's not the first time this has happened to Taiwan. Mm-hmm. So the community accepted it, the government overreacting. Whereas it's kind of different out here, in California, where there's still people that are against, sheltering at home and, they're wanting.
Yeah. What is that? Have you got to observe that at all? That phenomenon in the U.S. where people are being defiant just for the sake of being defiant? I don't want to be reductionist about it. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people are feeling a lot of hardship right now. But in terms of the defiance of it in the U.S., it seems like it's something uniquely U.S. related or U.S. born.
Well, I mean, there are 26 million people that are laid off here. I think I can see it. They're hurting financially. So it's difficult. It's a difficult mm-hmm. time. And nobody's helping them. The government's really not helping them. They say they are, but they're not getting the help they need. And they have to make payments. And they have bills to pay. They have credit cards. So I understand the difficulties. But
it's a bit of a short-term pain for a long-term gain, I guess, is the goal there. I see you have family members trying to get your attention, which is totally fine. It's no problem, but just a few more questions. I'm not going to keep you much longer. And so another thing I wanted to highlight, and it is something that has been kind of weird in terms of like how people are. You bring up the example of Taiwan, and then first thing they say, oh, they're close to China. Of course, they got to be prepared for this stuff, which is partially true. But then they start saying things like, oh, Taiwan has more of a collectivist mentality than a place like Canada. And I'm like, what does that mean? And I don't see, I mean, people are just as entrepreneurial there. People are just as hardworking. I mean, they're very family oriented, of course, and they're very community oriented, but there's a level of individualism there as well that exists anywhere in the world. I think it's a bit of a cop out that some people cite that as some reason why Taiwan got it right. And without, it's just a way for Westerners to perhaps maybe dismiss that the example. Can you speak to that a little bit?
I think being a smaller country, or I mean, smaller in the sense that news travels really fast in Taiwan, and people have seen what SARS can do. Because it's on the news every single day, for like Taiwan news, there aren't that much to report every day. So once anything goes on the news, it's repeated day after day, it's like keep repeating all day long, and people absorb all that really, really fast. And from that experience, and from the avian flu, and from just not long ago was the swine flu,
mm-hmm.
right? Swine flu from China. So we're used to seeing these things in Taiwan, and people are used to the government having a response to it.
Yeah.
Right. And when the government mounts a response, and the citizens, they're very willing to, because it affects their economy huge time, right? With the swine flu, if it came to Taiwan, I think we're one of the few countries around China that didn't get any. We had zero swine flu that came in, right?
Right.
Same thing with MERS. When MERS was,
Middle East Respiratory Syndrome.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So none of that came to Taiwan, right? Ebola too. So all these little things, all these epidemics that are going on. Taiwan always has a reaction to it,
right?
And it has a good response to it. And And like I said, I think we're very, we respond to what the government wants us to do in terms of that, you know, in preventing an epidemic.
Right. And I don't think that's much different from Canada. Canada, we're very responsive to, you know, any kind of dissent or pushback or even scrutiny of government is part of any democracy, thriving democracy, as Taiwan certainly has. But in Canada, we're generally responsive to the importance of government dictates in terms of responding to a crisis. So I don't see our country as being much different. In fact, I see us being more similar in that sense than others. So I think it's a cop-out that some commenters talk about Taiwan as having this uniquely collectivist society that tends to be more acquiescent to government dictates. And speaking of government, I mean, it also helps that I think your vice president is an epidemiologist, an infectious disease specialist, which of course would have given unique insight into how to respond to this current crisis, this current pandemic as it was emerging. And I find it incredibly sad that, you know, one, Canada didn't have a plan on the table, two, that Taiwan's early warnings to the world through the WHO, of which it's not a member right now because of the political tensions between Taiwan and China, went kind of ignored or unnoticed, and those didn't get out to the rest of the world, including evidence that it was transmissible, person-to-person contact transmissible. That came out of Taiwan very early on. Taiwan sent over a fact-finding mission to Wuhan in the early days to bring back all this information. That's how they knew. And a lot of the warnings weren't heeded. And, of course, a lot of the world's paying the price. But, Dr. Wong, I don't want to take up any more of your time. I really appreciate you coming on the broadcast here. And I wish you and your family a safe time in California there. And sure. I really appreciate you dedicating some time to us today. And I hope to have you on the cast again in the near future, if you would so have it. Tell anyone if you have any type of public social media presence or anything like that, you can perhaps tell people how to get in touch with you if they need to.
Actually, I'm pretty low key. So
If you want to get in touch with Dr. Wong, info@pod6.com. That's info@pod6ix.com, and I'll put you in touch with him if he would need it. Because you had some good information today, especially the revelation of how you started noticing this disease emerge in Taiwan, at least as an ailment, a unique ailment that wouldn't respond to traditional treatments early on, as early as November and December. That blew my mind because I haven't heard that before at all. But again, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it, and we'll talk again soon.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.